Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today is Justice April Ferris of Houston's First Court of Appeals. Justice Ferris, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I know probably a lot of our listeners in Texas are familiar with you already, but kind of tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, you know, kind of where you've been.
Absolutely. So Governor Abbott appointed me to the First Court of Appeals here in Houston on January 1st of this year. And it's been just a fantastic experience. Before that, I practiced for over 10 years doing appellate litigation, mostly at Yetter Coleman, is based in Houston, but I also worked for a period of time in the Texas Solicitor General's office, handling high profile appeals, the state of Texas. And that was a lot of fun. Before I went into private practice, I clerked for Judge Jennifer Walker Elrod on the Fifth Circuit here in Houston. And that's when I moved to Houston and really came to love the area. And before that, I grew up in Big Spring, Texas. I went to college at Abilene Christian University. And then I went to Harvard for law school, also known as the UT of the North. So I've been all over, but I'm a Texas girl, and I was really excited to come back and practice and ultimately serve my state in the judiciary.
You and Justice Jeff Boyd have an Abilene Christian Alumni Texas Appellate Judge Association?
Yes, we do. It was so funny. I had not met Justice Boyd before he was appointed. And I was just so excited. You know, I thought about emailing him out of the blue. And I was like, well, no, maybe that'll make me look like a stalker. So I'm not going to do that. So when I heard he was giving a talk in Austin, where I was at the time when he was appointed, you know, I went and introduced myself, and he's become a great mentor for me. And I know ACU is very, very proud of the good work he's been doing.
So how was it? Todd and I have wanted to have some people from the SG's office. Can you kind of just tell us a little bit about your experience at the SG's office and what that office does appellate wise?
Yes. So I would tell any, you know, young lawyers who are maybe 3 or 4 years out who are interested in having an appellate practice to consider trying to get a job in the Texas Solicitor General's office, because it is the best training ground I've ever seen for young appellate lawyers. And the reason why is the Texas SG's office is structured so that that office has its pick of any appeals, you know, that are going through the state system. So, you know, little screener memos will come up through the office that say, you know, what the appeal's about. You know, it might be from the tax division, it might be an election law case, it might be, you know, something like with a habeas issue or something like that. But there's just such a broad array of cases that you can work on there. And the SG's office has the option to take any appeal that it wants. And so, you know, for kind of small appeals, if you're just kind of getting your feet under you, you know, you'll be lead counsel. You go and you run with the case, you do all of the briefing, and you go and argue it at the end of the day. It's your case. And then also, the SG's office handles, you know, some of the biggest and most high profile appeals that the state has. And so there are also cases that are kind of big team type cases where, you know, you might have 5 or 6 lawyers and the SG will ultimately argue it himself. But you also get a lot of experience, you know, working with more experienced appellate lawyers in those big team cases. You learn a lot. So I was really grateful for my time there. And I ended up getting to work with a lot of people. You may recognize their names now. So I worked with, you know, Judge Andy Oldham. I worked with Magistrate Judge Ferrer. You know, just I worked with, you know, Solicitor General Keller at the time. So, you know, I got to learn from a lot of really smart, you know, people who were further along in their careers than I was. And I loved it. It was a lot of fun.
Westlaw Edge is the standard for legal research. Bringing together a legacy of quality and accurate legal research, and the latest advancements in technology. First-of-its-kind features like the next generation of legal search, intelligent document analysis, integrated litigation analytics, and the most powerful Citator expedite research tasks that were once incredibly complex and time-consuming. Westlaw Edge allows attorneys to deliver the fastest answers and gain the most valuable insights, providing a clear strategic advantage. Be a better attorney, make your firm better, and serve your clients better than you have before with Westlaw Edge.
There was some incredible opportunities, I'm sure, for advocacy, not only in terms of preparing the briefs, but oral argument. We see, you know, the Texas Supreme Court docket pretty regularly, folks from the SG's office making argument there, or even in some cases splitting time with some of the private litigants because of their amicus positions that they're taking. And not only there, but of course at the Fifth Circuit, and even more famously at the U.S. Supreme Court in certain cases. So I'll just echo what you said. I think from an outsider's viewpoint, it's just a great training ground for newer appellate lawyers. But from what I've seen, aside from the actual SGs, people tend to go and actually stay there for quite some time. I've seen some folks there for 10 years or more.
Yeah, I mean, there are very few jobs where you get to do all appellate, you know, true appeals all the time. You know, when I was in private practice, I had an appellate practice, and I consider, you know, jury charge work and dispositive motions to be a part of appellate practice 100%. You know, if you do a lot of time on those issues, I think you still have what you would call an appellate practice. But the SG's office, it's truly all briefs all the time in the courts of appeals. And, you know, if you want to volunteer to go handle, you know, something in a trial stage, then you could probably do that. But I just can't think of any other, you know, comparable job where, you know, if you love being in appellate court, that you can just do that, you know, pretty much all day, every day. In private practice, I'd actually taken a Criminal Justice Act appointment case as my first oral argument. But after that, you know, my next oral arguments were all for the SG's office. And, you know, it was really exciting to be, you know, a young lawyer and getting to argue in the Third Court of Appeals, getting to argue in the Fifth Circuit. You know, for an appellate lawyer, that's a dream come true.
Absolutely.
And what great experience, you know, going back into private practice from there. It would take a very long time to build up that same level of experience if you'd only been in private practice and hadn't had the opportunity at the SG's office.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, it's sort of like the appellate equivalent of the DA's office for people that do criminal law. You know, you go into the DA's office and you're just feet to the fire, trying a lot of cases quickly, you know, that you wouldn't get in civil. And it kind of sounds like the SG's the same thing on the appellate side almost.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. Because I'm sure y'all probably have older partners in your office who talk about, you know, the good old days of the 1970s when, you know, they got to try, you know, 40 insurance cases a week or whatever, and, you know, really got to cut their teeth. But from what I understand, you know, opportunities to get into a trial court are even hard to come by these days. And, you know, I think you have an even smaller number of appeals, and because, you know, so many cases settle out between here and there. So definitely, if you want to be an appellate lawyer, it's really important to, you know, try to get some oral arguments, you know, whether in a government post or, you know, a Criminal Justice Act appointment, or, you know, maybe pro bono, but however you can do it, it's important.
I know one of the things that you wanted to talk about today was why you wanted to become a judge. Can you kind of tell us your reasons for wanting to be on the bench and how you got there in that path?
Definitely. So I grew up, you know, very interested in the legal profession. When I was in college, I took a job at the county attorney's office in Howard County out in West Texas. And I cataloged all of the misdemeanor card files, put them on computer for a minimum wage all summer long. But the county attorney let me come and watch him whenever he was in court. And I just loved it. And my grandfather, you know, had been a U.S. history teacher turned principal and superintendent. But, you know, he gave me books about the U.S. Constitution and the founding fathers, you know, from a very early age. You know, I remember being such a dork. I was probably the only third grader who had memorized we the people, you know, in order to form a more perfect union. And
you weren't, by the way.
Yes. I'm not going to. But, you know, I grew up going to, you know, Colonial Williamsburg and just trying to learn everything about American history that I could. And I just really came to respect what an amazing product that our U.S. Constitution was. And, you know, that set me on the path to wanting to clerk. I clerked for Judge Elrod, and I got a great experience with her. She was really committed to equal justice. And, you know, she took pro se cases very seriously. If anybody didn't have a lawyer, she was going to, you know, read those briefs maybe two or three times over. So I knew if I ever had a chance to be on the bench that I wanted to, you know, serve my community in that way. And so when the opportunity arose, I put in an application and I was very excited to be selected. It's the biggest honor I've ever had. And I'm just so happy that I get to serve the state of Texas in this way.
And welcome to the bench and political campaigning, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's been an experience.
Oh, yeah. I never run for public office before. You know, I think the closest thing that maybe I ran for was like Pledge Mom president, you know, back in the day at Abilene Christian. The thing that I love about it is it gives me an excuse to go out and meet people. I've always been an extrovert, you know, and I love appellate practice, but it does kind of tend to, you know, to lock you in your room with a bunch of books. And now I have an excuse to, you know, go to, you know, chili cook-offs and CLEs and just go to everything I can go to try to meet all of the people, you know, in the 10 counties that make up our area. It's been fun so far.
I bet you're learning some geography of the area that you probably didn't know a lot about, you know, being centered in Houston before.
Definitely.
Extrovert and appellate judge aren't necessarily exclusive, but extrovert and appellate lawyer coming up, that's a little more rare. But considering your current position, I think that's probably the best personality type to have, considering.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'll tell you, lockdown was hard, you know, because I was used to, you know, my poor introverted colleagues. Like I would always, you know, go down to people's offices and say hello and, you know, chit chat at the water cooler and like, oh, I just read this interesting case. Have you read this interesting case yet? And now I have to pick up the phone, you know, or email them. But my colleagues on the bench, you know, have been very welcoming and very accommodating. And if I've been bugging them, they haven't told me that yet. So.
Well, and that you are kind of unique because you were in private practice in the pandemic and then you actually went on the bench in the pandemic. So have you actually been on the bench yet?
No. So I have only been on the proverbial Zoom bench thus far. But, you know, that has also actually had a really interesting silver lining, you know, just in my years of going to appellate arguments, you know, you might have 10 people in the room, maybe 40 people for like a huge case, but, you know, very rarely are you going to pack the halls for an appellate court argument, you know, here in Texas. And we've had hundreds of people watch many of our Zoom arguments. And in fact, I had my daughter's Girl Scout troop for their Civics Day badge watch part of an oral argument. And they thought it was really interesting. And, you know, we talked about the different roles, like, you know, do you want to be the litigant? Do you think it would be fun to, you know, go into court and argue somebody's case? Or, you know, what do you think about being a judge? Look, we have like lots of amazing women judges on our courts of appeals and our Texas Supreme Court. And you could just see their eyes light up and, you know, really get excited thinking that that could be them someday. So,
well, you know, there's definitely downsides to Zoom oral arguments, but I think that's one thing that I've loved about Zoom hearings and Zoom oral arguments is I can from my computer just kind of peek in on what's going on around the state in a way that was never feasible before. I mean, it is kind of fun just because I'm a nerd, you know, hey, let's get on the YouTube page and see who's having a hearing. Oh, this person, you know, just for interest, because it is cool to be able to look, you know, hey, what's going on out in West Texas? What's going on down in East Texas? And especially on the appellate courts, like, unless I'm there to argue a case or go with somebody, I'm never in the Houston Court of Appeals to just watch oral arguments. And now I can.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, you know, been a golden opportunity. And, you know, I think everybody's excited to get back in the courtroom, but I hope we can find a way to hang on to some of this because it's good for everybody. You know, it's just so useful to be able to pop in and see what's going on in these courts across the state. And I feel like it kind of brings us closer together as a profession also.
We had an argument in the Waco court in my office this week, and it was actually held live, but the court still broadcast on YouTube. And there was some discussion sort of off the record, but on camera about the court, you know, continuing that practice in the future. I think that may be the best possible outcome, really, is to let's keep the courts open and broadcasting on YouTube, but allow the litigants and the judges to come in
to get back in the courtroom. Yeah, I think that would be a really good solution going forward, because I've always loved how the Texas Supreme Court records their arguments. And if you've got somebody in your office who's arguing that day, but you've got too much on your plate where you can't just drop everything and go to Austin, you can watch them in real time.
Yeah, it is great. And we're lucky that the Supreme Court has sort of been leading from the front for the last decade on this kind of stuff. And I mean, even the Fifth Circuit at least records their arguments, so you can get them, but it's not quite the same as seeing it live. I don't know. There's just something about watching the back and forth between the lawyers and judges on video, or live on YouTube or whatever, that does kind of bring a different experience than just listening to audio.
Definitely.
So you've spent years at the SG's office, you spent years in private practice. What have you kind of learned since you've been on that side of the bench, though? Has there been anything that's really surprised you, or things that you've seen that you weren't expecting?
The biggest surprise to me is, really the degree of preparation, that goes into the argument and how that comes across, when somebody's in oral argument. Because whenever we set a case for oral argument, I'll have already read the briefs, I'll have already read the key record excerpts. And so I've really, maybe got three or four questions in my mind that I'd really like answers to. And you can just tell when people, when people are prepared, like you can tell who knows the record cold, because, sometimes they'll even, predict my questions before I ask them. And so, say something like, this one part of the record that makes it clear why, my client should win. And, those are the types of things that I think are really helpful, even if you don't have them memorized. But, something I would advise litigants to do is, if you know there are sticky parts of the record that are going to come up that people are going to have questions about, maybe have like a tabbed binder so that, you can just flip to that part of the record, because that's really where oral argument becomes very useful, where you can, kind of drill down on the one thing that may be, giving you some questions about whether to rule for that party. So you can tell who does a good job with preparation on those sorts of things.
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedeas bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
Do you kind of come in with a sense of where you're going on the issues before oral argument, or do you kind of come in with a little bit of an open mind and see where the parties go?
So I come in with an open mind. If it's a case that we've set oral argument on, it's because we don't know what we're going to do yet. But, a lot of times, I'll think like, well, it looks like we should probably go this direction, but I have a big question about, this one thing. And so oral argument is very helpful for, kind of fleshing that out. And that's one piece of advice that I would give to parties, is not to run away from a question, because that question really is the judge trying to sort things out and maybe trying to figure out how to go your way. And I think sometimes like attorneys can be very jumpy, and kind of want to run away from that and, go back to their outline. But usually, everybody's done a really good job on the briefs, and we know your story, and we know, kind of the bigger picture, but we've got like, one sticky issue that we'd like to kind of sort out. So I would just always say, never run away from a question, even if you don't have a good answer at the time, offer to, submit a letter brief to follow up. But yeah, just I think the piece of advice that I got that was most helpful for me as a practicing lawyer is you're there to be helpful to the court. You're not there to rehash your brief. You're not there to sway the court with, overwhelming oration and persuasion. You're there to help the court solve the problem at the end of the day. And if you can help the court with what the court's worried about, then you're going to be doing your client a really big favor.
And that's one of the marks of a really good appellate. I mean, a really good appellate advocate is knowing that that's the function of counsel, especially at oral argument, is to answer the court's questions and be helpful, because you don't want to throw up roadblocks at that stage of the case. Exactly. I mean, if you want the court to rule your way, you've got to be prepared to answer those tough questions, even if, as you say, Judge, it requires, an answer like, well, I haven't thought of that exact issue, but I'd be glad to submit a post-submission letter to the court. How have you adjusted to seeing a regular influx of criminal cases come across your desk. I know, I think you mentioned doing some pro bono work in criminal law, but I suspect in your private practice, you weren't seeing that on a regular basis.
I was not seeing it on a regular basis. So I did my first oral argument case in the Sixth Circuit, and it was a Criminal Justice Act appointment case, habeas matter. And I was so lucky because I had now Judge Cam Barker as my mentor at the law firm. And he had, you know, had lots and lots of criminal experience. And so he taught me so much about, you know, that area of criminal law just to get ready for that case. I ended up winning. It was my very first argument and I won. And so that was really exciting for me and made me think that, you know, that appellate idea might have something to it. But I also did a little bit of criminal when I went to the Fifth Circuit, or not, but the Texas SG's office in my Fifth Circuit, there was a criminal case. So I've done some criminal, but the thing that I've been doing the most is, you know, reading cases as they come out of the Court of Criminal Appeals. I've been really getting to know some of our staff attorneys who are, you know, true experts in criminal law, and also doing a lot of, you know, criminal CLE and self-study on different issues as well. But, you know, the great thing is, you know, we've got a good Court of Criminal Appeals that has provided, you know, a lot of opinions that are just very clear and easy to follow. So I'm grateful for that. And whenever they issue new releases, I'm always, you know, glued to those when they come out in the morning. So
how does your court do preparation and assignment? And I guess what I mean is, do y'all meet before you have oral argument? Do you assign cases before, or do you just kind of each prepare on your own and then come in and that's the first time you've really conferenced about it?
So they're pre-assigned, and usually, you know, the judge who is going to be, you know, handling the majority, you know, will draft the memo and everything. But, you know, once you conference, you may find out that you may have been assigned the majority, but now all of a sudden you're in dissent. So, you know, things can certainly change around, but, you know, all the judges are still doing like Zoom conferences. So we'll, you know, get together on Zoom and talk through our cases. And a lot of times, you know, they're just really clear and everybody's in agreement. And occasionally that won't be the case, but everybody's very respectful. You know, the staff attorneys will usually join us in our conference, which can be very helpful because a lot of times they've read, you know, all the nuances of the record. And so it seems to work really well.
Before you took the bench, you're one of a handful of people that I think of off the top of my head as having a, I would say, an expertise in the TCPA. Is the number of TCPA cases you've seen so far on the bench about what you would have expected? And has that expertise really helped you in dealing with those?
You know, that is such a quirky little statute. So yes, I have seen TCPA cases. Yes, doing all of those far too many CLEs on the TCPA has helped. You know, it was so funny because the way that I got involved in doing TCPA is I had an older partner when I was at Yetter, his name was Charlie Parker, you know, come into my office one day and he said, you know, something's going on with this TCPA. Like, you know, I'm seeing opinions that are surprising me. I want you to learn everything you can about the statute. And I want you to give, you know, an internal CLE presentation to our firm, you know, about this statute. And I was like, oh, okay, okay, you know, Charlie, I'm sure it's very interesting. And then I started looking at the cases and I mean, my mind was just blown. And so, you know, I put together a CLE presentation just for our firm, but I'd already done all the work. And so I, you know, thought like, well, you know, why not try to take the show on the road? And then I think I've done more than a dozen TCPA presentations. I could probably go the rest of my life without doing another TCPA presentation, actually. But you know, like I said, I'm an extrovert. It gives me an excuse to go out and be with people and get out of my office. So I'll probably do a few more.
Hopefully the new statute will make it not as impactful as it was. I feel like there was about a 5-year period where it just sort of swallowed up the entire civil court system because there was not a case where arguably someone couldn't try and fit it in some way or another, it felt like at least.
Yes. And I read a law review article that I think said like at one point the Dallas Court of Appeals' docket was something like 40% TCPA cases, which just blows my mind.
Mind blowing.
Yeah. I don't think we're anywhere near that level anymore.
I hope that was just on the civil side. But it wouldn't shock me if it was all cases.
Yeah. What an interesting little unit in our state's jurisprudential history.
Well, I mean, if you ever want to teach a course on like textual analysis, that is the statute to talk about, because it's, I mean, such unintended consequences from the legislature based on what I think they wanted to do versus what they actually accomplished really seems like there was a huge mismatch there.
Yes. And, you know, at my CLEs, I tell people, you know, go read Creative Oil. I find that case to be fascinating. I really enjoyed, Justice Blacklock's description about the dogs and the cats and the stuffed animals. And, you know, it was just such an interesting way of, explaining statutory interpretation. And I think that goes to show, you know, when you're a judge, you can really break concepts down into like easy to understand lessons. And so I hope that I'm able to do that as well, because as we all know, statutory interpretation can get very thorny. You know, it's something that I think if you don't get a course on it in law school, you should really try and learn it once you get out. Because if you can really master statutory interpretation and get to the heart of things, then that's going to make you a very good lawyer for your client.
I remember when the TCPA first came out, I think it was Judge Pemberton in Austin that wrote an opinion where he kind of broke down and made these hypotheticals. Like, if I wake up in the morning and I lean over and I talk to my wife, you know, that's a communication. And then I go and do, and he kind of broke it down like that, just sort of illustrating a little bit of the absurdity of some of the interpretations of how broadly it was written. And that has always stuck with me as like kind of a good, same thing, a great way to explain that in sort of a funny way, but also making a pretty good point with it.
I recall that one well.
Was that your case?
No, it wasn't my case.
I hope I'm not bringing up bad memories for you.
No. And I believe it was a concurring opinion. So I wouldn't fault Justice Pemberton for that. But it is one of the more creative concurrences that I recall seeing, illustrating arguably the relative absurdity of the previous version of the TCPA.
Yeah, the old one, definitely. How has it been? I know we've talked a little bit about oral argument, but how has it been doing that on Zoom? Have you kind of learned some things from the judge side that advocates should know in that medium? Or,
you know, I have to say one benefit to it is I think people are just a little bit less formal or less nervous. I don't know what it is, but, you know, I can remember as a litigant, you know, having a lot of nerves and, you know, seeing other advocates, you know, when you get in that, you know, big, gorgeous room that makes you feel 2 feet tall, you know, and the judges are elevated, you know, it gives you a sense of, you know, the perspective and the importance of our judiciary and our judicial system. But I think a lot of times it can also make you a little bit nervous. And I think probably because people have been doing so many Zoom meetings, probably far too many Zoom meetings, that, you know, it really feels like you're just having a conversation, you know, with the attorneys and trying to kind of flesh out, you know, the wrinkles to get to the decision that you need to make. And I kind of like that, you know, it feels a little bit less formal and it feels easier to talk to people. So
what about briefing? I know as an advocate, you kind of wear one hat when you're writing your brief and then you're looking at the other side and responding to it. Are you looking at briefing in a different way now or seeing things in briefing that you hadn't really noticed or thought about when you were on the advocate side?
Yes. What I would say on briefing is, I mean, we just have such a large volume of briefing that I was always, you know, kind of one to ride up to the word limits, you know, because I mean, most of the cases that I handled were pretty complex and really justified it. But oh man, if you've got a case where you can, you can make it just a little bit simpler, I really appreciate brevity, you know, especially, you know, if your issues are simple and straightforward and you've got, you know, the winning precedent on your side, don't belabor the point, get straight to it, say, you know, this Texas Supreme Court case controls, you know, get in and get out. And I think it makes you appear stronger. Also, I really have come to enjoy briefs where people use the table of contents kind of as an advocacy tool, because, you know, a lot of times you don't really pay much attention to your headings, but the headings can tell the story. And so I like briefs. The headings are basically a one-page summary of all of your arguments. And I think that's really helpful. And, you know, there's other tips I could give. But yeah, basically just go through your brief after you've written it and see what you can cut. Because a lot of times, you know, you're just saying things that are repetitive and your good ideas can get lost when, you know, when there's too much repetition. So I know it's always harder to write a long letter than a short one.
It is.
A short letter than a long one, I believe, was the Jefferson quote.
Well, and on the advocacy side, you don't want to give anything up. It's so hard, you know, to feel like, oh, I've got this brilliant argument. And you don't want to let go of any point that might
Yeah, and definitely, like, you know, don't cut your points, but you've already made the point twice. You don't necessarily need to make it a third time.
Right. Are you a fan of really weaving the more important facts into the argument and keeping statement of facts relatively short? Or do you prefer to see all the facts sort of laid out up front in the statement of facts section and simply referred back to in the argument?
You know, I think it really depends on the case. Yeah, that was one of the things that I always found really interesting when I was an advocate, was I would, you know, write the statement of facts before I would start the argument. And then sometimes I would realize that I was just, you know, repeating and duplicating. And so I would, you know, that I would go back and maybe, you know, cut my statement of facts or cross-reference. But to me, you've just got to kind of see how it writes. There's not like really a hard, fast rule in every case, I think.
Seems like that's a place, though, where at least in the actual statement of facts section, judicious use of words is probably advisable, because I think, especially if it's the trial lawyers handling the briefing, they want to tell the whole story and not leave out any details, and not really necessary to appellate brief.
Definitely. And a lot of times, you know, people use so many dates. And so, well, like, you know, when I'm reading through the statement of facts, I'll start like really zeroing in on these dates, you know, thinking that there's going to be, you know, maybe a problem with the notice of appeal deadline or something like that, or statute of limitations. And then it turns out that the dates didn't matter at all. So, you know, if you're looking for words to cut, a lot of times you don't actually need those dates. So unless they're pertinent to, you know, some issue.
I know exactly what you're talking about. When you start reading a brief and there's all these dates, then you get to the end of it and you're like, oh, those were just some dates. Okay, well.
It's just there. Okay.
Okay. Were you surprised by kind of the flow and volume of work that you've had as an appellate justice?
Really, it's been pretty manageable, you know, coming out of private practice, you know, where you're working around the clock. And I mean, right now it seems like, you know, there's plenty of hours in the day to get to all of our cases and everything. So that's been a good feeling.
Do you have a sense of where the first court's docket and filings are right now relative to where they were kind of pre-pandemic? I know some courts have gotten slower. I know others have not. Do you know where yours is?
I can't recall right offhand. I think we're pretty par for the course.
It'll be interesting to see in a few months when people really start trying cases again, what that's going to look like. Because I bet all of us are going to see it just a completely different world.
Yeah. And I think we're ready for the upticks.
Have you all talked about, I see you've got actually probably 7 or 8 cases set for oral argument going all the way into the end of June. And it looks like they're largely criminal cases, somewhat surprisingly. But has there been a discussion about, now that things have opened up a bit more, about coming back to the courtroom and doing some of these live?
I think I would be surprised to see any live arguments before summer's over. By time we're into the fall, my guess would be having oral arguments. And I don't have any, you know, firm dates on anything, but I would suspect would be going back to the courtroom after summer. So
have you been able to be in the courthouse much? It's such a beautiful space. And it's a shame that you haven't been able to, you know, actually go in and be on the bench yet.
Yes. So the reason I'm not in there today is because I wasn't sure, you know, how to necessarily set up my husband's microphone with my equipment at the courthouse, but my husband also is my tech guy. if I wanted to work from home today, he told me he'd get everything set up here. So that's been great. But I actually love going up to the courthouse. You know, I tell everybody I worked remotely before it was cool, because I had a baby back in November of 2019. So I was working from home a little bit, you know, before the baby came. And then I had a couple arguments set during my maternity leave. And so I kind of took a maternity leave with some interruptions and then made up for it on the other side. So I was doing a lot of work from home. And then the actual day that I was supposed to come back to the office was the day that they closed my office for the pandemic. And so I've been, you know, working remotely since like October of 2019.
Wow. So you were social distancing before it was cool.
Before it was cool. I am so ready to see people. So ready to see people. And my poor husband's an introvert, and I'm sure he's also very ready for me to see people again.
I can hear it in your voice how ready you are. And gosh, you know, on the one hand, you were prepared very well for what was to come with the pandemic. But on the other, gosh, what an experience you've had with not only going through all that with having your baby and dealing with oral arguments while on leave and all that, but then lo and behold, you get appointed to the appellate bench and now you get to start a whole new job during this crazy time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it has been a surreal last year and a half, because I argued, I guess, back in March of 2020, early March of 2020, in the Sixth Circuit. And I think they closed the court and went to all remote the very next week. But, you know, I flew on a real airplane. I shook hands with my opposing counsel. You know, it was just such a different world.
You're not going to know what normal is like when all this is over.
Yeah, there'll definitely be some stories for sure.
Is there anything that maybe lawyers don't know about the way that your court works that you wish they kind of understood that would make it more helpful?
You know, to me, it seems like so many of the lawyers that we see are very good and very good at their jobs, and they know how to serve their clients well. The biggest thing I would say is candor to the court. You know, if there's a point that's not great for you, just go ahead and acknowledge it up front. Like, we're not, you know, I'm not saying like concede something or, you know, do something like that. But we all know where the weak points in our cases are. You know, otherwise, you know, people wouldn't hire you if it was an open shut case with absolutely no chance of winning. So I would just say, you know, if you know where the hard places in your case are, just, you know, be forthright about that. And a lot of times you'll win anyway. But yeah, just honesty is great. And we always appreciate it. And yeah, so honesty, clear writing. But yeah, here in Texas, we're really blessed with a very, very high quality bar. And I've been so impressed with the litigants that I've had, and, you know, the experience to read their writing or see their arguments.
And when you hide your weak argument in a footnote, somebody's going to find it.
Somebody's going to find it.
Well, we're getting to the end of our time that we set today, and we really appreciate you being here, taking the time to do this, working from home to have your tech set up. But we always like to leave our guests the chance to offer maybe some tips, and you've given us some great ones, or a war story to close out. Do you have anything you'd like to give?
I would just say, you know, continue to check those Zoom filters, you know, on it. I don't think we've gotten a cat yet, but, you know, sometimes, you know, we'll have somebody, you know, whose name isn't quite right or something like that. But, you know, people are doing a great job, you know, adjusting to this kind of strange new normal, and, you know, just watch for little tech glitches and hangups. Everybody's doing a great job. So just, you know, from the bar to our litigants out there, thank you so much for being flexible as we kind of work through, you know, all these procedures and technologies, and thank you for serving your clients well.
Well, Justice Ferris, it's been so great to have you. We've certainly enjoyed hearing from you, and you've given some really great advocacy tips, good things for people of all experience levels to keep in mind. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed your podcast, and thank you so much for the service to our bar and to the state. It's been great.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.